Welcome to the Bone Coach Show, dedicated to helping you understand all things related to diet, lifestyle, bone health, and how you can live and thrive with low bone density and osteoporosis. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, certified health coach, health and wellness speaker, and above all else, your bone coach. After being diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 30s, I transformed my health through diet and lifestyle and now help my clients and community members do the same through my online coaching practice, BoneCoach.com. Look, there are no quick and easy cures for low bone density, but the choices we make every single day can have a powerful impact on our bones, our health, and our general well-being. I'll share the research, interview the experts, and help you figure out how to get the conditions right in your body so you can better your bones through diet and lifestyle. Short disclaimer, I'm not a medical doctor and this show should not be considered medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making medical decisions and changes to your diet and lifestyle. With that being said, let's get on with the show.
Let's say that you've decided, I am going to do this. I'm going to go gluten-free and dairy-free. But I know if I see whole wheat bread and cheese, I'm going to eat it because that is just so delicious to me. So now I'm going to have a conversation with my family, identified what it is I want to be doing, and I've identified will tempt me. So now I'll have a conversation with my spouse and perhaps my children to say, this is what I want to do. I know you guys love whole wheat bread and cheese. You get to have it. I can't. So let's talk about how you get to have your bread and cheese without tempting me. So you keep that not in our house. You're going to go out and have that, or you're going to have it, and I'm going to go with friends, and I'll be out of the house when you bake the bread, have that yummy sharp cheddar cheese, and eat it all up before I get home. So we either take me out of the environment while you're having it, or you're going to have it out of the environment away from me.
If you haven't done so already, especially if you're newly diagnosed with osteopenia or osteoporosis, or if your most recent bone density scan still showed more bone loss, go ahead and pause this episode and head over to BoneCoach.com to sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart guide. That's going to give you everything you need step by step by step over the next 7 days to get on the path to improvement and stronger bones. You won't want to miss that. So pause this right now. Head over to BoneCoach.com and I'll be here as soon as you get back. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Show. Joining us today to explore multiple sclerosis and its connection to your health, your bones, and osteoporosis explained is Dr. Terry Walls, MD. Dr. Terry Walls is an Institute for Functional Medicine certified practitioner and conducts clinical trials in the setting of multiple sclerosis. In 2018, she was awarded the Institute for Functional Medicine's Linus Pauling Award for her contributions in research, clinical care, and patient advocacy. She is the author of The Walls Protocol, a radical new way to treat all chronic autoimmune conditions using paleo principles, and the cookbook, The Walls Protocol, Cooking for Life. Dr. Terry, it is great to have you here today. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, so let's first start by, let me just kind of open this up and talk about the connection between MS and osteoporosis and why this is so important and relevant to our audience who is focused on bone health and osteoporosis. There's increasing evidence that MS, multiple sclerosis, is associated with an increased risk of osteoporosis and fractures. And this is for a few reasons. The first one could be due to physical inactivity, right? If you're not placing healthy stress on the bones, and if there's a reduced mechanical load, this can lead to bone loss. So it's very much use it or lose it applies to your muscles and your bones. Low vitamin D levels, the use of medications like glucocorticoids or anticonvulsants, and then also the inflammation associated with an autoimmune condition that's not in remission, right? So all of these things could be contributing factors. Dr. Terry Walls, could you explain to the audience, what is multiple sclerosis and what is happening in the body when you have it?
So this is a condition where the immune system is attacking the myelin, which is the fatty insulation around the wiring connecting brain cells, brain cells in the brain, in the spinal cord, and out to the cranial nerves. That will show up as altered sensation, difficulty with movement, difficulty with nausea, vomiting, double vision. And for a long time, we're really focused on this being strictly an immune problem in that the body was attacking self. More recently, we've come to understand that there's also a neurodegeneration problem where the brain volume is shrinking, the spinal cord is shrinking, and the robustness of the cranial nerves is also shrinking. So there's a combination of excess inflammation and this neurodegeneration, which I think is driven by mitochondrial dysfunction. You and I talk about bone health. So excess inflammation can be a problem for bone health. But I think also mitochondrial strain can be a problem for bone health as well. So both elements, the mitochondrial strain and the altered inflammation, are part of the drivers. And if we go to the neurologist and say, so what causes MS? They'll tell you that you have to have the wrong genes, the genes that put you at risk. There appears to be a triggering infection. And we know that there are 16 different viruses and bacteria that increase the risk for developing MS. But the vast majority of people who get those infections never get MS. So there's another set of environmental factors that the conventional world will say, well, we don't know what they are. And in my world, I say, so what? We know what all the factors are that are associated with health. Let's work on those. And when we do that, we often see that the severity of the MS and neuroimmune problems steadily declines, and that people have, you know, less fatigue, better energy, better mood. And when they go in to see the neurologist says, you know what, you don't have any enhancing lesions this time. Keep up the good work. And then they pretty soon they say, and you know what, the lesions you did have are a whole lot smaller. And then they say, well, you know what, I'm really not finding much disease activity whatsoever. And then you can begin to have the conversation, could I transition to a less potent disease modifying drug?
That is such a great foundation for what we're going to, the other pieces that we're going to talk about here. And I know that you have a personal story and healing journey with multiple sclerosis too. So you suffer from multiple sclerosis, severe pain. Could you just tell us a little bit more about your story?
Yeah. So I'm a conventionally trained internal medicine doc. I went to medical school, graduated in 1982. And in retrospect, that's when my first symptoms began during medical school, these bouts of electrical pain that would gradually get more troublesome. No clear explanation. I finally went to see a neurologist tried taking Tegretol, developed a drug rash, had to stop, and I tried a variety of other drugs, none of which helped. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to have to put up with this. And these episodes would come and go. Then in 2000, as I'm out walking with my wife, Jackie, a half mile from home, my left leg grows weak, dragging it to hobble home. I see the neurologist the next day and he says, Terry, this could be bad or really, really bad. So I start doing the workup. And I think about my 20 years of worsening face pain. And I'm like, oh my God, this, I don't want to be disabled. So I'm praying secretly for a fatal diagnosis. 3 weeks later, I hear multiple sclerosis. I do my research. I find the very best MS center in the country. I see their best physicians. I take the newest drugs. And still within 3 years, I'm in a tilt-reclined wheelchair. My face pains are relentlessly worse. And that's when I ask myself, am I doing all that I can? So I go back to reading the basic science. And I'm reading basic science articles about MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease, ALS. And they decide that mitochondria dysfunction is what's driving disability. So I create a supplement cocktail for my mitochondria. It slows my decline. I'm very grateful, but I'm still declining. In the summer of 2007, I discover a study using electrical stimulation of muscles in people who are paralyzed. And I convinced my physical therapist to let me have a test session. It's actually quite painful, but I feel really good afterwards. So we add the E-stim to my physical therapy. I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine at that same time. I take their course on neuroprotection. I have a longer list of supplements. And then I have a big aha. And Kevin, I'm actually embarrassed now by how long it took me to have this aha, because it's like, you know, I've been doing a paleo diet for 5 years, but what if I redesign my paleo diet based on this long list of supplements? So it's more research. I figure out where they are, where those ingredients are in the food supply. And I have a very structured paleo diet of what to be eating. And I start this new way of eating December 26, 2007. Now, at that time, I'm so weak, I cannot sit up in a regular chair. I'm in a zero gravity chair with my knees higher than my nose. I can take just a few steps using two walking sticks. I have developed brain fog, which is why my chief of staff assigned me to the traumatic brain injury clinic, which I was going to have to start the first week of January, because and I was going to be examining patients without residents. And this was going to be physically far more demanding than what I can do. And my face pain was relentlessly more severe, more difficult to turn off. And when it turns on, sound triggers the pain, light triggers the pain, chewing triggers the pain, swallowing triggers the pain, talking triggers the pain. So I'd come to terms with I was going to be bedridden by my illness, demented by my illness, and probably have my face pain turn on, and that I would be stopping swallowing, talking, and because I'd changed my living well such so there'd be no IV fluids, you know, it was going to be a pretty miserable last 10 days of my life, if that would come to pass. So I've redesigned my diet. January comes, I go to the traumatic brain injury clinic. In the first 2 weeks, I'm just watching. And like, I should be able to do that from my zero gravity chair. And then the third week of January, now the fourth week of doing this new way of eating, it's my turn to start seeing patients. And I come home the first day and I tell Jack, well, you know, it went okay. I was sort of surprised. And then on Friday, at the end of the week, from having seen people all week, I'm like, you know, that wasn't too bad. And you know, honey, could I sit in a regular chair? So for the first time in years, I sat in a regular chair for supper. Like, that was a big deal. And then when I went back to see my physical therapist, he goes, you know, Terry, you're definitely stronger. And he advanced my exercises. So now I'm doing 10 minutes twice a day of my electrical stimulation and my mat exercises. And we steadily advance those. And then I begin walking in the VA hospital with my two walking sticks, stunning people like, oh my God, Dr. Walls, you're walking. And then I'm walking with one walking stick and then with no walking sticks. And then on Mother's Day, so 8 months into my e-stim, 6 months into my new diet, I want to try riding my bike. And we have this emergency family meeting. And Jackie tells my 6'5", 16-year-old son, Zach, you run alongside in the left. She tells my 13-year-old daughter, Zeb, you run alongside in the right, and she'll follow. And I get on my bike, and I bike around the block. That big 16-year-old boy, he's crying. Zebby's crying. And when I, you know, and I'm crying. And of course, when I tell that story again, I still cry. Because it was at that moment that my understanding of disease and health was changed. And you know, after that, I biked a little bit more every day. And then in October, Jackie says, let's sign you up for the Courage Ride. It's 18.5 miles. And once again, you know, when I cross that finish line, my kids are crying, Jackie's crying, I'm crying. And this fundamentally changes the way I think about disease and health. It will change the way I practice medicine, and it will change the focus of the research that I do. And now we've done multiple trials, testing my protocols and others with multiple sclerosis. And I've made it my mission to teach other clinicians and to teach the public that there is so much that we can do that will change the direction of our health. Even if people tell you that you have a severe disease that you can't recover from, that there is no treatment for, there's so much that we can do.
Dr. Walls, that is such a heartwarming an inspiring story. And what I love about your story is that you didn't just take this information that you learn and just focus on you and continuing to improve your own health. You've gone and helped thousands upon thousands of people develop a better plan, make progress, make improvement. And I would love to understand more about the clinical research that you've done.
Yeah.
And what are the most impactful things that you've found?
You know, so does Wild. I had my recovery story. My chief of medicine at the university is a rheumatologist. And I'd gone in for my every 2 year review, and I walked in. Yet, and he hadn't seen me in quite a while. Last saw him, he was in that wheelchair, and he thought I was on that new drug, wonder drug, Tysabri. He said, "No, actually, I'm not on any disease modifying drugs right now. With my neurologist's blessing, I'm just doing." And I showed him my eSTIM device. We talked about my program of self care, and he gave me the job of getting a case report written up. And said, like, on me, he said, yeah, this is so important because people don't come back from secondary progressive MS. Because he's a rheumatologist, he understood that. And so I got that written up. Then he called me back and says, "Now I want you to do a safety and feasibility trial." And he had told me that he wanted me to write out very carefully the protocol that I'd created for myself. And I explained that I didn't know how to do clinical research. He goes, "You know, Terry, I'll get you the mentors. This is your assignment." And so I salute, like, okay. So he got me the mentors, and we did that first clinical trial. And then through some grateful patients, we had a little bit of funding, and we did some small pilot studies. And then we're able to do larger studies looking at the effect of diet and lifestyle. The first papers that we did, which was really just replicating my very complicated regimen of very structured paleo diet, targeted supplements, daily meditation, daily exercise, electrical stimulation of muscles, in other people with primary and secondary progressive MS, who are also, like me, severely disabled between cane and walkers. And they were able to implement this complicated regimen. And we had remarkable reduction in fatigue, remarkable improvement in quality of life. And half of these folks had clinically meaningful improvements in hand function or hand and walking function. Really quite remarkable, because with progressive MS, you expect a 10 to 15% worsening in everything every year. So instead of worsening, we held the group as a group stable, and half the folks had clinically meaningful improvement. Then we started studying just diet, and we've done seven trials. We're into our eighth trial now, and consistently show that as people implement, the Walls diet level 2, they end up with better energy, less fatigue, higher mental quality of life and physical quality of life. Less anxiety, less depression, and better working memory. That's a very, very, very consistent finding. Now, what is interesting is that when I first started talking about my experience in the little local organic grocery stores, in churches, temples, synagogues, mosques, I was going where I was invited, then the local MS society chapter asked if would I come speak to them. I said, sure. I got interviewed by the clinical advisory committee, who thought I had a very dangerous message. And I got banned as a speaker. I did my TED talk, which went viral. And so a lot of neurologists had to deal with their patients coming in saying, "Well, what about that doctor in Iowa?" I really got condemned for having, such a dangerous, dangerous message. Now, mind you, Kevin, my message was eat more vegetables, get rid of the sugar, work with your personal physician to ask for a referral for physical therapy and stress reduction. Pretty dangerous message. But people were afraid that patients would refuse the DMTs and just want to use diet and lifestyle. I'd never said refuse the DMTs. I just said, ask for vegetables and ask for referrals for physical therapy and a stress reduction technique. When we did our first clinical trials, we finished them in 2011. At the time that my TED Talk was going on, we'd finished the first trial. We were presenting it at a local brain science meeting, actually an international brain science meeting. And it took us almost 2.5 years to find a journal that would publish that data, because it was so hard to get reviewers who would review a paper that talked about diet, stress reduction, exercise, electrical stimulation of muscles, because people would say, like, I'm not an expert in that. So that was very hard. Then it took us another year to get the next paper published. But now we had two papers published, and we would gradually, that would take us, so we had a paper out in 2014, 2015, then we had several papers out in 2017. And, you know, gradually we're able to find journals that would publish our work, and we're slowly able to get into slightly higher impact journals. And now I've had, I think, 26 manuscripts related to MS, diet, nutrition, finally accepted. You know, we've had 45 peer-reviewed publications when I look at all of my body of research. It's a process, doing research. It's not a sprint. It's a process. And when you're doing things that are new, people think you're crazy at first. You know, and certainly the first several years, they thought our ideas were very unorthodox.
Well, thank goodness you stuck with it. And you didn't let that dissuade you from continuing on.
Well, you know, and I'm also, I'd say, a unique scientist that makes people a little bit nervous, because I have skin in the game, because I have MS, I have profound disability. I have this personal experience. I had this personal transformation. Fortunately for me and for the world, my chief of medicine said, this is a really very important observation. And he said something I think is quite profound. One case report can change everything. It takes one person to see that this was an unexpected clinical outcome that's worth reporting, talking about the potential mechanisms of why this outcome happened the way it did. And then we wrote a case series. And so that's usually how science goes. You get a case report from somebody who saw an unexpected outcome. Then you see it in a few more people, so you write that up. And then you do a little single-arm trial. See, like, can I replicate this going forward in others? And we did that, and we replicated it in two little trials, one of 10, one of 20. And then we start continuing to investigate this in little clinical trials going forward, you know, and progressively larger trials. And so now we have a really big trial going on. But, you know, Dr. Roth was right. A case report has potential to change everything if they will then do the case report, case series, single trial to replicate it. And then you begin doing randomized controlled trials. And that's what we've been doing. And, you know, I've been working with my mentors. And then, because, you know, people, you know, correctly say I have a conflict of interest. So what we do is that, I don't have contact with or consent people who are in my clinical trials. We collect the data prospectively. The statistician who does the analysis is masked to intervention assignment. So, you know, intervention A, B, or C does the analyses, writes the reports, gives a copy to the funding organization and to the University Conflict of Interest Committee, and then has to, and he's also on all of our manuscripts. It never gets any better than that in terms of managing the conflict of interest. So anyone who says that they can't trust my publications because I have a point of view, didn't bother to understand the conflict of interest management plan that we have, which means my statistician analyzes the data, writes the reports without knowing what the intervention assignment is.
That's, well, the other thing that, this makes me wonder too is, what is the biggest difference between the drug studies and the food studies too?
Sure. So if you do a drug study, and most of the research world is designed around drug studies, I can take drug A, drug B. One of them has the active compound and one has an inactive compound. So as the patient, I wouldn't know if A or B is the active compound or the inactive compound. And neither would any of the study people doing the assessments, or the pharmacist, or the patient, or the people analyzing it. Now, in a food study, people know what they're eating. People know if they're on a usual control diet, or if they're in a parallel arm diet, so they're comparing two diets. You know what you're eating, so the people know which arm they're in. My assessors can be masked, and we do a very good job to ensure that they don't know. And we keep reminding people when they come in to be for all their study visits, remember, you can't say anything about what you're eating to any of the staff, because they need to not know what diet you've been assigned to. And because what we eat is so personal, a reflection of my cultural values, my family values, my personal values and tastes, that it takes a lot of work to get you to stop eating the things you love and to start eating new things that whose tastes you may not be familiar with, whose ingredients you aren't familiar with. It's a lot of work. And so there's a process of helping people make those changes and be successful. And I would also say, Kevin, so people who are willing to sign up for a diet study, who've said like, okay, I have a bad disease, I want to do a diet study, I want to be in the intervention arm. What? I'm in the control arm? Screw that. You had to tell me what the intervention diet was because you had to put it in the consent. I'm just going to follow that on my own. And a lot of people do that. So they probably have a diet that's somewhere between the intervention diet and their previous diet. It's sort of somewhat better than what they were eating before and not quite as good as the intervention diet. So we know that always in a diet study, both arms improve. The intervention diet has a bigger improvement than the control diet. And in my current study, I tell everyone that I expect, you know, we have two intervention diets and one control diet. We expect the control diet people to improve their diet at least somewhat. And so they'll probably improve somewhat as well.
That's great. Now looking out to the future, do you expect scientists are going to find a drug that actually helps people grow more myelin?
Well, you know, we have a lot of drugs that do that right now that are really very effective in mice and in rats, and in tissue culture, do a great job of growing myelin. However, when we test them in people, the effect size is just so tiny. So I'll move my finger. They're so very, very tiny. And that's because in mice and rats, we control what they eat, what they do, what time the lights go on, what time the lights go off, how much activity they get. When we give drugs to people, they get to eat what they want. They have fights at work, fights with their spouse, their kids are acting up. And so we have all these other environmental factors that we can't control. So I predict that drugs will help maybe a tiny bit, unless we help people address all those lifestyle factors, we'll be severely disappointed.
Understood. And what are maybe some actionable things that people with MS can start doing today that are going to help them feel better?
So let's talk about the things you add, because I think that's probably the easiest. So adding stress reduction, you know, whether it's a stress reducing app such as Calm or Square, you can do that to your phone. Some breathing meditations, You could do Epsom salts, baths and soaks. You could improve your sleep. You could have a gentle exercise program. You and your tribe are very into exercise, weight bearing exercise, strength training. Those are all great things. We can improve the quality of your diet. So eat more of these radical things known as non-starchy vegetables, green leafy vegetables, cabbage family, onion family, mushroom family vegetables, brightly colored things, carrots, beets, berries. Then we can talk about the things to remove. Oh, then we should be sure you have plenty of protein. A lot of folks are very into sugar and carbs and have not enough protein. So I want to be sure you have enough protein to run the chemistry of life. And you could do that as a vegetarian or as a meat eater. And then the things to remove. Study after study has shown the more sugar you have, the more high fructose corn syrup they have, the more flour-based products, so pastas, breads, cereals, the more problem your diet is. You don't have enough vitamins, nutrients, minerals. So get rid of the sugar, the processed foods. For many, and I know your story, gluten sensitivity drove your illness. People with gluten sensitivity have a higher rate of neuroimmune problems, psychiatric disorders, neurologic disorders. So take at the least gluten out. And many with gluten sensitivity also have a sensitivity to dairy protein. So take casein out. If you'll take out the flour-based foods, cereals, pastas, breads, that'll take out a lot of harmful food.
And a lot of times people hear that and they're like, oh,
it's too hard.
When I hear, or when sometimes we suggest people make modifications, adjustments, and tweaks, you know, and I've even heard this with my own mother at different points, you know, I don't want to remove the only things left, right, that I can, that just taste good and give me joy in life. So how do you talk to people in terms of like focusing on abundance too?
So what I do is, that's why I said we start with the ads. So add in my VA practice, I'd say it's 9 cups of fruits and vegetables, preferably 9 cups of non-starchy vegetables and berries, and then eat what you want. And they'd be like, is that 9 cups per month or week? And I go, no, that's per day. Oh, well, they said, so just start adding 1 cup a day, then go to 2, then to 3, and work your way up to 9. And when we get to 9, we've crowded out a lot of bad food. And then when they're coming back and they've got their 9 cups in, they're still having some beer, they're still having some gluten, then we'll talk about using gluten-free products instead. And and I used to be very emphatic that I wanted them to start on diet first. I finally started listening to my patients and realizing that for some, they need to start on stress reduction first. They need to start on exercise first. They need to start on improving their sleep. And as they did their stress reduction and their sleep and exercise and their overall inflammation went down, then it was easier to contemplate, okay, I'm going to work on diet. And then we worked on the ads to get more vegetables in. Then I'd say, okay, can we start reducing the sugar? And then we get the sugar out. Then we can have the conversation, are you ready to go gluten-free? And I'm not looking for 5 servings of gluten-free bread. I'm looking for an occasional gluten-free product. And if we make the changes at the next small actionable step, step by step, people will be more successful. If you're in my clinical trials, we work with you to implement all of this much more rapidly. If you were in my clinical practice at the Veteran Affairs Hospital, we would do this at a pace that you and your family could implement. So, you know, it depends. We do it at a pace that you guys are able to do. And some people are miserable enough. They're like, okay, I will go purge everything out of my house and we will do it. And others have to do it very much step by step.
Yeah. I love that you kind of gauge where people are at. too.
Yeah, you know, and I ask them, so I say, the most effective intervention will be this, XYZ. Is that something you can do, or do we need to do this at a slower pace? And if we do, what could you be successful at? And it was my professor, Bill Bean, that taught me this. He said, so you teach people, here's the intervention. And then you ask them, so what did you learn today? And what are you going to do? And then, so I learned very quickly that I was not as effective at teaching as I thought I was. And I also learned pretty quickly that if I didn't give people, make it easy for them to say that was too hard, I was missing a big opportunity. So then I added in, what can you do? And do we need to do something else? And that will let you have a conversation with your patient and say, okay, so what could you do?
I love that. I love that. And maybe you can even just share any other helpful tips. If one piece of advice maybe that you've got or a couple helpful tips for somebody who is, you know, starting this journey with MS, or they're just diagnosed, or maybe they've been on the journey for a while and they just need help. What would you say to that person?
You want to do this as a family. And what does doing this as a family mean? So let's say that you've decided, okay, I am going to do this. I'm going to go gluten-free and dairy-free. But I know if I see whole wheat bread and cheese, I'm going to eat it because that is just so delicious to me. But I really want to be gluten-free and I want to be dairy-free. So now I'm going to have a conversation with my family. I identified what it is I want to be doing, and I've identified what will tempt me. So now I'll have a conversation with my spouse and perhaps my children to say, this is what I want to do. I know you guys love whole wheat bread and cheese. You get to have it. I can't. So let's talk about how you get to have your bread and cheese without tempting me. So you keep that not in our house. You're going to go out and have that, or you're going to have it and I'm going to go with friends and I'll be out of the house when you bake the bread, have that yummy sharp cheddar cheese and eat it all up before I get home. So we either take me out of the environment while you're having it, or you're going to have it out of the environment away from me. Or it might be that we're going to have cheese. It will be only in the refrigerator downstairs in that special refrigerator, and that you guys will fix meals with that when I'm away or not at home. So we want to acknowledge that people who don't have the need to avoid these foods get to have them. We want to acknowledge that it's a problem for me, so I need to not have them and I need to not be tempted. Because the reality is, foods that are delicious will find your mouth and you'll eat them for a long time. And it will take a while for you to develop the resistance to those tempting foods. Because food, delicious food, it can be addicting.
I love this. And it's understanding too, like your family wants you to be in good health. Right. And
unless you have a very dysfunctional family that's sabotaging you. And occasionally, what we discover is that the family that doesn't want to support you in any way, that's probably symptomatic of some serious family conflict that needs talk therapy to work through. So you can resolve that or realize this is an unresolvable problem and maybe a separation and restructuring of the family is warranted.
Yeah. I mean, because relationships can affect your health too. Negative relationships.
Oh, absolutely. And occasionally we talk about we have to detoxify, get toxins out of our life. And occasionally it's toxic relationships that are sabotaging us.
Dr. Terry Walls, this has been such a helpful conversation. And I know our audience has appreciated this. I would love for you to share, where can people find you and your work? And we'll make sure we leave those resources in the show notes as well.
And let me also talk briefly about the clinical trials that we're doing.
Please.
So my current clinical trial will be one of the largest, longest dietary studies that are underway, comparing a ketogenic diet, the modified paleo diet, to usual diet. and we'll follow people for 2 years. You'll come to Iowa City, get baseline assessments, then we'll randomize you to one of those three diets. You come back for some blood work at 3 months, and then again at 24 months. We'll have MRIs, so we'll get brain images. We'll see changes in brain volume. So we're very excited about that. You can learn more about that at Terry Walls, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, WAHLS.com/MS study. If you just want to learn about me, you can just go to terrywalls.com. And I encourage you to sign up for my newsletter so you can hear about our research updates every week. And follow me on Instagram, Dr. Terry Walls, D-R-T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, W-A-H-L-S. That way you can see what I'm eating and doing and hopefully get a lot of inspiration there as well.
Wonderful. Well, I absolutely love your work, have always been a fan, and I'm looking forward to actually your study that you're working on now. I'm looking forward to seeing what comes of the study too. So
it's going to be super exciting. We will finish enrolling people, and our last study visit should happen in 26. At the end of 2026, we'll be analyzing it in 2027. And you'll hopefully be getting it out at the end of 2027.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, your expertise, your time. And for everybody listening, you can find all of the resources, the show notes, everything mentioned here today over at bonecoach.com/Dr. Terry Walls, osteoporosis, multiple sclerosis. We'll see you in the next episode. Hope you found this episode of the Bone Coach Show helpful. You can find all the resources, show notes, everything mentioned over at bonecoach.com. If you enjoyed this episode and found it helpful, be sure to share it with someone you love, a friend, family member, even a group of people. And also be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode that can help you improve your bones, your health, and your future. One last reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com. for more great resources to help you get on the path to stronger bones and an active future. I'm your Bone Coach, Kevin Ellis. I'll see you in the next episode.